From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Scientists say we're entering a new epoch, a new period of geological time that's defined by humanity's impact on the planet, especially its ecosystems. Scientists call it the Anthropocene. They say it's threatening plants and animals around the globe. Some will survive, others won't. And looking at the challenges Florida faces in this new era is bringing experts to FGCU next week. We'll talk with the scientists behind the Biodiversity Conference. Plus, Fort Myers Police Chief Derek Diggs has been on the job for roughly 7 months. He's pushed for more community outreach, but last week, an independent audit of the department shows deep problems with roots going back nearly a decade. He now has a list of recommendations to turn things around. We'll talk with him about his plans for the FMPD and how efforts to rebuild relationships within the community have gone so far. But first, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Fort Myers Police Chief Derek Diggs has had some time to settle into being the new head of an embattled department, and just last week received the results of a third-party audit of the city's police force. We'll talk with him later in the show about whether there are any investigations stemming from that audit and what changes he's already implemented at the Fort Myers Police Department. But first, the who's who of scientific community will gather next week at FGCU for a conference to tackle challenges to biodiversity in what's being described as a new epoch. According to scientists, the Anthropocene epoch began when human activity began impacting the Earth's geology and ecosystems. The issue is, will this new epoch be too much for certain species to survive? Here to talk about that is Dr. Edwin Everhan, FGCU professor and program leader for environmental studies. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Julie.
We're also joined by Carol Lefebvre, an assistant professor of environmental scientists at FGCU. Glad to have you here.
Thanks, Julie.
And also John Cassani with the Calusa Waterkeepers, who helps spearhead next week's conference, is in the studio as well. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Julie.
We're talking about the upcoming conference at FGCU, at which scientists will look at what challenges plants and animals face heading into a new epoch of geologic change. Change, scientists agree, is being caused in large part by humans. Share your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. At Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. First, Dr. Everhan, as a professor of environmental studies, can you tell me what an epoch is? And am I pronouncing it correct?
Yeah, you are. And it's a geology term that breaks up the long history of the planet to particular stages when change changed. Geological patterns on the planet have driven the shape of the planet and the kinds of things that live on the planet.
And so what's led scientists to believe that we're entering a new one?
Well, I think everybody who looks at change on the planet, everybody who looks at biology, everybody who looks at the life that we share the planet is, sees that the rate of change has really accelerated since humans have been shaping so much of the planet.
And how are we doing that?
Oh, all
kinds
of things. Yeah, we alter the hydrology on the landscape. We change the habitat. We shift habitats around. We move species around. Increasingly, we're coming to understand how much of an impact we're having on climate by changing, by putting new gases up into the atmosphere. If you think about the atmosphere like a soup, you put different ingredients into the soup's going to taste different and it's going to act different. And that's what we're doing to the atmosphere.
So like we're putting a lot of rosemary into our beef broth and it's getting very different.
Yes. Yeah.
So the question being addressed at this conference is challenges to biodiversity. And so for people who are not so attuned to environmental issues, biodiversity is kind of a tune-out word. You hear biodiversity and you're just like, oh, environmental stuff. And then you just kind of stop there. But if you could, can you unpack that word for me? Are we talking about the specter of having fewer and fewer varieties of plants and animals on the planet?
So I really hope Kara and John will jump in on this. So I'll start with that first question about what does that mean. It's really a combination of the two words, biological diversity. So in simplest terms, it's looking at all of the different kinds of life that we share the planet with. Or it can be looked much closer, all the different kinds of plants and animals that we share Southwest Florida with. And for me as an ecologist, one of the critical pieces about biological diversity, I think about our ecosystems as being really closely related to our economies. And so when you have an economy that's based on a whole bunch of different ways that people make a living, it's more stable, it's more consistent, it's more able to respond to the changes that inevitably happen. And when we have ecosystems that are based on lots of different kinds of animals that we share them with, they're more resistant and they're more resilient to change. They're more stable. So I think that for me, the critical part about biological diversity is understanding that more is better.
More difference.
Yeah.
Like diversifying your portfolio, for example.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Yeah.
That makes sense. Kara?
Yeah, I was going to say that the reason that variety is so important is we're not just talking about different species, but also the genetic components of those species. So biodiversity includes the very blueprints for life. Also, the ecosystem functions that happen because of species interacting. So things like pollination, water filtration, those are important functions that happen because of biodiversity.
And you're an avian person. You're more in the bird world. So how do rapid changes in geology, how does that impact birds?
Very fundamentally, for different reasons. For one, the way we are fragmenting habitats as humans has a direct impact on birds. Birds depend on the resources in the environment for mating, for feeding, for all of their functions in life. And so when we disrupt their habitats, we disrupt those bird populations. Also, changing climate is having a big impact on birds because it changes the cues that birds need to know when to migrate. It changes things like the eruption of their food sources, the availability of insects in the environment for them to eat, for example. So important changes.
Well, and then also, John Cassani, you're fairly specifically involved in the water issues of the Caloosahatchee and the Everglades. So what are you seeing with the rapid changes so far?
Yeah, you know, habitat's kind of at the basis of what's driving this change, and we see that change in aquatic environments as well in the river. Actually, the logo for the organization I work for is a small-toothed sawfish, which is a critically endangered fish in the Caloosahatchee River. So we're seeing lots of changes. Once those fundamental habitat features change, the plants and animal communities respond to that in various ways. And unfortunately, sometimes the end result of that is extinction. And the small-toothed sawfish, as one example, is just right on the edge, right on the edge.
So what would you say to someone who says, I never knew a small-toothed sawfish existed before. Why would I care if it's still around? What would be your answer to somebody that would say something like that?
Yeah, the relevance I think that should be to the average citizen or the non-science citizen is that, you know, biodiversity in all its forms and complexity and dimensions is what enables life for our species on this planet. It's you know, we're one thread in that fabric of life on the planet, and when that fabric gets thin, it has major implications for our own species.
It's a lot easier to rip a hole when you have fewer threads.
Gets back to what Wynn was saying about the more diverse the systems are, the more stable they are. The more they're able to resist major storm events. The more they're able to resist invasion by exotic species. And that can have a cascading effect that can affect human existence.
So if I could add to that, Julie, and sometimes I think about something like I've never seen in the wild a small-toothed sawfish. I'd love to. I think so part of it for me is just this joy of engaging the landscape that we live in. All right. So if they disappeared, well, I never got a chance to see them. But I think particularly the things that exist on very low levels, we should be paying attention to that because it's a signal that we can listen to. So if we're losing species, which has happened through time.
Can you give me an example of, for example, a little-known species that ceased to exist, and then what happened as a result of that? Are there any of those?
I should have a good answer for that. Have you any of you guys got that? Dang it, let me think about that one.
You know, because I think I've heard anecdotally, a plankton or whatever, or some very small organism that nobody really thought a whole lot about. And then when it was gone, it had a ripple effect upwards.
Yeah, if you guys have a good answer, that's good. I gotta think about that.
It's going to pop in
like you know, the answer, the reason we're all struggling with that is the things we don't know. We probably lose things that we don't know about all the time.
Yeah.
But I think watching things that are at low levels is keeping our finger on the pulse of the ecosystems that we're a part of. So if the small-toothed sawfish disappears from our waters, there's a reason for that. And we should understand what the reason is.
Because it probably won't be the only one.
Yeah. We're all connected. Aldo Leopold wrote one time, to save every cog and wheel is the first rule of intelligent tinkering. And what humans do, because we're smart and we wield power, is we tinker with the environment that we're engaged in. And so we need to understand what that tinkering is doing. And then we need to save the pieces because we don't know exactly what all their roles are.
And figure out how to retreat and back out of things once you do make different amendments.
I think
so.
Yeah, we should learn from our mistakes.
Yeah.
I hope that we do.
If people need economic arguments to be able to understand it too, there are many. For example, most of our medicines come from plants in tropical rainforests. The foods we eat depend on pollination by insects in order to even be able to exist. So there are a lot of strong economic arguments to appreciate biological diversity, although that's just part of the picture.
Does it ever get tiresome trying to defend something that seems so basic, that protecting biodiversity, I mean, to you, it's just kind of as natural as breathing. Does it get difficult trying to continue to convince people the validity of this?
So before we answer, does it ever get hard to communicate nonverbal stuff on the radio? Because you asked that question and all three of us smiled and we're shaking our heads yes.
There's a lot of nodding.
I would say it isn't difficult. It's just puzzling. It would be like arguing, why should I care if I tear down my own house? You know? It's puzzling.
It's frustrating because as scientists, we witness this change. We see the profound cascade effect of changing ecosystems when diversity is lost. And so to us, it's so relevant. But to most folks, there isn't that relevant connection that would change their outlook on life. And that's part of what the conference is about, is we're trying to elevate dialogue on that message so that people understand that more.
It's just hard to get it communicated in words that people are engaged with or that they want to, you know, learn more about. But I think that having specific breakout sessions about things like butterflies and panthers and little things that are interesting to people, that might get people in and get them to stay.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about the answers that you guys got. Is it frustrating? Yes. We'd like people to be thinking about their future. I don't think it's puzzling because I've always thought that the trouble is that so much of raising awareness about the impact we have on the environment has been couched in catastrophic terms, you know, loss, and that people have a limited capacity to deal with bad news. And so I think part of the conference, we want to look at what's the state of these situations, but also how do we communicate it and how do we translate it to how we manage things. So, you know, sea level's coming up. People could still argue about their perception of the degree to which humans are driving that change, but the change is happening. So part of the conversation has to be, how are we going to respond to that change? And that doesn't have to be all negative. It can be, we understand the change we're having on the planet, and we're going to figure out the right way to go forward into the future.
That's pretty tempting, though, to live in denial.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's, I guess, the frustrating part, is living in denial, because it isn't going to go away.
Well, and you study it. You are in it, and you study it all the time, so you see it all the time. And
I'd say we're all in it.
Yeah. Well, we're all in it, but you're looking at it every day, more so than most people. Most people are figuring out their grocery list.
Yeah.
We're talking about how species are being pushed to adapt to a new epoch, one which scientists say was begun by human actions. It's the topic of a conference at FGCU next week, and we're talking with two of the participating professors, Dr. Edwin Everham and also Kara Lefebvre, as well as one of the organizers of the event, John Cassani, with the Calusa Waterkeepers. You can become part of our conversation, too, by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK, or you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. And Dr. Everham, is this new geological time frame moving more quickly than epochs of the past?
I would say yes. You know, it's hard for us to sometimes get rates in what happened in the past. Certainly when the asteroid hit the planet 65 million years ago, change was wickedly quick that day. But the kinds of changes we're seeing on the landscape are happening in weeks, months, years, decades, rather than longer periods of time. And that certainly stresses not just humans have difficulty dealing with change. Everybody has difficulty dealing with change.
Well, it has been pretty hot.
Yeah.
The last few seasons. I mean, I don't mean to make light of it. But I mean, is this going to create stresses on the species that are now living more so than it did in the past because it's happening so quickly?
Yeah, I'd like to hear John and Kara's response to that too. But I'll say yes, because one of the responses to things like sea level rise and climate change in the past has been movement. And one of the things that humans have done, Kara referred to it a minute ago, is that we've chopped up landscapes with roads and other uses that are going to make it hard for some species to move across the landscape the way they might have done in previous epochs.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the – you brought up the acceleration of change, and it's that rate of extinction and change in species composition that's so mind-boggling. If you take amphibians, which are kind of the poster child for change on this planet, you know, here's a group of animals, first ones to crawl out of the oceans and develop the lands 100 million plus years ago.
That we probably have share some genetic information with, since they were ultimately our ancestors. Well,
part of the evolutionary process. Yeah. So as one example, their extinction rate's about 200 times the background rate. That's pretty fast. If you take all the species that are on the brink of amphibians, it's about 25,000 times the historic rate. So it's going really, really, really fast. And it's largely human-driven.
Is there any reversing that? Is there any way to put the brakes on?
Yeah, I struggle. I really struggle to create an outlook that, yes, there is a positive response to that. But there's so many dynamic drivers involved that's going to make it really difficult. The most immediate and abrupt change to these populations is habitat destruction. But as those populations get really small, it's a combination of what we call amplifying effects that actually drive them to extinction. And there's so many of those factors involved. It's really a hideous thing in many ways. That's why ecologists are so, so concerned right now that we may not be able to really actually reverse it. So the paradigm now is how can we conserve what's left? What's the best, most cost-effective way from a policy point of view to conserve what's still left? Maybe on the brink, we may be able to save it. And that's going to be part of the discussion next week.
Yeah, but I have to have a desperate optimism. I have to believe that we can respond. First step is understanding the change better, what's driving it. I think locally, if you look at how we certainly just went into another phase of rapid development of this landscape. You know, we've popped out of that economic downturn. But I think what we're going to see in all of the new places that we're building is a little bit more of a push for green space within the gated communities, a little bit more of an honoring of wetland habitats within the landscape, so that we may be seeing putting humans on the landscape while we're same time we're protecting natural biodiversity. Now, that will slow loss. We may not have to have – John and I have talked about ideas about, you know, reintroducing some reptiles or amphibians into restored places where they were extirpated. You know, mm-hmm. They're locally extinct. But now we've managed the landscape, got rid of invasive species. They could thrive again. But we – so for me, part of it is going to be we've pushed nature into so many weird places. We may have to put energy and effort back into repair.
Yeah, that repair is going to be pretty critical. We do have a phone call coming in from Lee in Naples. Lee, what would you like to ask?
You were mentioning earlier about a small or unknown or just an insignificant animal that might cause an impact on a larger environment. I was curious what your thoughts were on the disappearance of the honeybees.
Yeah, that's an important thing, and you're hearing a lot about it, about the honeybees.
Lee, I put my arms up and said thank you because I didn't come up with an answer. Although I appreciate you bringing up honeybees. It's probably not a good example because they aren't small or insignificant. They're incredibly important across our agriculture, and we are seeing declines. And, John, you may know better. Carrie, you may. I don't think we fully understand hive collapse, you know, exactly what's driving that. And so we better figure that out.
Yes, and it's not just honeybees, right?
It's
species of bees all over the world are being threatened both by habitat loss and by chemicals applied to them. So that's a great example and one that has an economic impact.
Yeah, and from a macro perspective of a person driving a car down the road, a bee doesn't seem like it's that significant, but it really is.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, they're responsible for pollination. Are we seeing locally honeybees having a difficult time, John?
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about pollinators in general, some of the more minor species of wasps and bees. And they're, you know, it's really interesting. Many of those only come to native flowers. They don't come to the exotic flowers. And so as we see these shifts in plant communities, it puts a stress on these native pollinators to survive because they have less native flowers to attend. And so it's that cascade effect. Everything's connected.
Yeah.
It's like the Frankenstein effect. You really never know what the outcome is once you start taking parts in pieces. It's what Wynne was referring to as keeping all the parts when you start tinkering.
But so we can build new developments for more people that are coming here, and we can shift away from bringing in weird plants from other parts of the world that have to be fertilized and watered to make them healthy. Put native plants back into our backyards. Put them into our medians. They don't have to be fed and watered the way that these exotic species do.
Yeah, kind of like that zero landscaping where you use only native stuff.
Yeah, put stuff here that belongs here, and it's going to help the insects that belong here and
all the little guys.
Yeah. In the long run, it saves us money, which is not a bad thing
to
do.
It's cheaper, too. You don't have to water it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we're going to have to wrap things up for now. But if you would like to get more information about the Biodiversity Conference next week, which is from March 7th through the 9th, you can check our website at wgcunews.org. I want to thank so much for coming in, Dr. Edwin Everham. I keep on sticking a D on the end of that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
And Kara Lefebvre and also John Cassani. I really appreciate your time coming in. It's going to be an interesting conference with people can learn quite a bit from it.
Thank you, Julie.
Coming up, we talk with the new chief of police in Fort Myers, Derek Diggs, about cleaning up troubles within the department from the past and how he plans to move forward. That's coming up next.